So we are back in public meeting, and session is now to report back on the breakout session, and we start with group one.
Okay, so I threw the question out there with my privilege, I guess, to summarize. On the slide I see I wrote in green, which is green from here, but it's not green from here. So anyway, apologize for that. So my contention was, and you know, many of you have heard me talk about this over the years, is that there are key disclosures from my particular experience, key disclosures which amazingly are not allowed to be put in the financial statement. Those key disclosures actually have a lot to do with how our management runs business. And they are key disclosures which have that horribly emotive word called non-IFRS disclosures. Even though they are fully extracted from the financial statements, one could say, if we felt we were allowed to do it, because they are extracted from the financial statements and is how the management runs the business, perhaps one could say you could even construct your whole segment reporting around those core measures. But at the moment, especially since my company is also an FBI and listed in the US, we have been strongly told by the US regulator that, hey, you are not. Be careful how you go in producing alternative income statements. You're not allowed to do it.
Why not?
Let me just finish my contentions, and then we have the. So, why is it that we view these both internally, and why do our users view this information as being so important? Is that our users, our analysts, tell us that they need that information so that they can adjust our IFRS financial statements to have more predictive value, especially predictive value on the cash flows, on a segment basis, on a disaggregated basis. So the provocative suggestion that we fed back to the team here was, why can you not be a little bit bolder in IAS 1 with something like, if management runs the business on a basis which is not the IFRS basis, why could you not put in IS1 some sort of wording to say that if management runs the business differently to the IFRS values, that can be included in the financial statements, it has to be reconciled to the IFRS information, and by the way, it's even allowed to be audited. So that was our provocative input to the team.
It's just we talked about that, but I still believe Gary had a great point. If you go down that road, the problem is that the current rules on segment reporting say now that you should report your segments based on how you run your business. And so why isn't there, I'm not being negative, but why doesn't that produce that information now? It'd be on a segment basis, which you have to reconcile to IFRS. Is, you know, based on our discussion, I thought we had a great discussion, is that I thought maybe that's a great idea, is have a separate footnote that says share information that management believes is the best for the capital markets, even if it's different than IFRS, and then reconcile. But how do you jive that with the current requirements for segment reporting? Either that's not the way you're running the business, but you think for some reason it's better to report to the street on that, which doesn't make sense to me. And so I like the idea of going down that route, but I think we may be in direct conflict with what we're told to do in segment reporting right now. I perceive it because of the mechanics we get caught up in segment reporting of what we try to say the CODM is actually looking at. But if we do put that forward, I think Gary can make the point, if this was his point, because that was a great point, is it seems like it's already there for us to do.
Mm-hmm.
PI subject to the nice enforcement by the USSEC, would you feel that you would have more freedom to do that just under the regulation of the Swiss authorities or the European authorities?
I think there would be more freedom, yes. I think that we would have a better case to be, I know this is publicly recorded, but basically my company has over the, perhaps it's now 2 or 3 years ago, but extensive discussions, which is on public record with the SEC about their views in this particular area. We were actually just talking about disclosures, not even in the audited financials, but in the OFR. And we were amazed how much pushback we got in the as to what we were allowed to disclose in the operating and financial review. We never got as far as the audited financial statements because there was so much resistance to have an alternative income statement presented.
Same experience here. We have to have a lot of space and a subheader between the revenue and the expenses to not make it look like a non-IFRS income statement. We are allowed to present revenue measures and expense measures and profit measures, but we're not allowed to present them in the way that it looks like an income statement.
So my wish, and I've said this in my time in many public fora, I'm looking for a way to legitimize what I feel is totally valid and, information. I'm looking to the ISB to help me by putting text in IS1 to legitimize what I think is very solid information, totally extracted from the financial information, and is actually, to my mind, even capable of
audit. I don't understand why you can't use segment reporting for this.
Because there is guidance from the SEC in the Q&A that the numbers for the segments would not be non-GAAP measures, but a respective number for the total company would be a non-GAAP measure. And the SEC tells you, I don't want to see non-GAAP measures in your financial statements. That's why you're not allowed to report the total for the company for the non-GAAP measures, even if it is your segment. So totaling the segment is okay, but then bridging it to the total number for the company is something you wouldn't be allowed. Same thing, if you wanted to make in your P&L a subtotal for your non-IFRS operating profit to then go on to operating profit and the rest, the SEC wouldn't allow that because that's a non-GAAP measure and they don't allow non-GAAP measures in the financial statements but only outside the financial statements.
But our segment reporting requirements say the measure of profit reported for each segment should be what is reported to management.
Yes.
But that's why if you report on the level of the individual segments, SEC tells you, that's fine, that's not a non-GAAP measure. But
then we say.
But if you report the same number for the consolidated for the company, SEC tells you that is a non-GAAP.
But we say you must then reconcile to the reported number.
Paragraph 28B of IFRS 8 says that.
Yeah,
but the SEC is stopping you complying with IFRS.
No. What you, for instance, you go, this is a total for my segments. Then you may go and say, well, this is the stuff outside the segments, smaller amounts. And then you would not be allowed to then make a subtotal and say, and that's what it is for the total company. You've got to first reconcile on the total segment thing over to the IFRS number and then add the rest.
I try to test it.
Weird, but that's the way.
A simple example, let's assume that in your company, the purchase price adjustments after an acquisition are not considered as part of the operations for the segment report. You report on profit before the effect of purchase price allocation and inventories, etc. So, in your idea, you would do the consolidated figures with profit before adjustments, purchase price, etc., and then to match what you have in the segments, or would you do a reconciliation, as Steve said,
of total segments, then the effect of the purchase price adjustment, and then move to the...
I think, Philippe, you are perhaps pushing me a little bit too far. I think what I'm still very clear in my mind of, if there was wording in the IAS 1 or some other IAS that somehow made it possible for management to, you know, somehow the IASB legitimized these types of alternative performance measurements, that would be, I think, very supportive. And we have to work out the wording. It might be there will still be some challenges. But at the moment, at least, I mean, I have to say IAS 1 as now written is relatively new, and that needs to, we need to digest that. It might be there's more flexibility in it. But certain before the revisions of IAS 1, it did not, we've turned it around many ways. We did not see the flexibility to enable us to report our alternative measures as we would have liked, and we had to report it externally outside of the financial statements.
Maybe the solution would say to say is this kind of number isn't kind of IFRS number, but it's not maybe has to be included in the P&L or has to be included in the to legitimize a kind of that this information is useful under IFRS.
All I'm giving you is input, I'm trying to give you input, but that I believe would be, I mean, it does seem a bit strange that we have key information that everyone wants us to provide, that for whatever reason, as of today, we've decided it has to be outside of the financial statements.
We are having some discussion in that area in the discussion paper about the presentation of performance measures. Because it's quite difficult to define what's the difference between an alternative performance measure and another performance measure. But it effectively builds on the amendments that we made to IAS 1, and effectively it doesn't preclude the disclosure of those measures, but it says if you are going to disclose measures of that ilk, then they should be fairly presented and give some information about what that fair presentation might entail. For example, reconciliation to the items, a label which clearly indicates what that is made up of. It's can't say it off the top of my head, but effectively it builds on what we've already proposed or is final in IAS 1.
Sandra?
I just caution the ISB just to make sure it doesn't allow companies to go too far. I do think you have to reconcile back to your GAAP measures. If you look at the restatements and financial statements that have been rescinded, a lot of times it comes from non-GAAP measures and people are trading on things, and I look at what the complaint is and I'm like, if they would have read the financial statements themselves, they would have had a much better idea and making investment decisions. And you know, some of the investors were relying on press releases that were using non-GAAP measures that gave an entirely different picture of the strength of the company and the operation. So just be careful and cautious on where you allow that boundary to go. And I think reconciliations are an important element of it.
Just summarizing what I think I heard, what the SEC is preventing is, I guess, preventing an arithmetic exercise. Let's say you have three segments, A, B, and C, and then you have other D. They're all in segments on a management basis. I guess the SEC, and I think this is true, is objecting to companies putting in E, which is A plus B plus C plus D equals E. They don't like E. So it's an arithmetic exercise. It's just a comment. But I think, again, I thought Gary mentioned this, and then Stephen just mentioned it. Steve just mentioned it again, is why can't companies or why don't companies have this information in the segment footnote? And it may be that what's being reported in segment footnotes, I'm not saying this is true or not, but what's being reported in segment footnotes may not be actually the way the company is being run. And what a proposal would be is have a footnote on a total company, getting rid, not thinking about the arithmetic thing I just said, that says report to users what is the best information about the company. I think you're going to have difficulty of trying to bridge, well, why isn't that segment reporting? And then someone's got to say, well, we don't run the company that way, but oh, by the way, we think that's the best information for users to receive, even though we're not running the company that way. So I think it's a valid question in that we should be able to do this with segment reporting, unless segment reporting truly is not reporting how management is actually running the company. If you don't agree with that, then you have the thing of saying, well, what you provide to users has to be a little bit different than why you're running the company, and I question why, and maybe there's a valid reason for that.
Okay, then let's go to group number two. Kevin?
I think we end up with similar positions where Malcolm's group, but we ultimately concluded that it's very worthwhile the ISB going down and dealing with the low-hanging fruit. So there's certain words that cause issues, and those need to be removed. One that I particularly used, and now I didn't mention in the meeting, I think after what Malcolm said is useful, is that in IAS 1, when it talks about comparatives, the words are, unless other IFRS require or permit. Well, that means everything except IAS 1. And so although IAS 1 has the materiality exception, the statement says unless others require permits. So that means you can't use the materiality exception for comparatives as an interpretation of the way the words can be used. So there's lots of low-hanging fruit which can be picked up in order to assist in removing the disclosure. But one of the things that I suggested at the meeting was that hopefully, this sounds quite heretical, that the principles of disclosure statement actually goes nowhere. That actually it becomes an agent of change rather than a statement as and of itself. And if we can use it as a behavioral mechanism rather than a clarification, which then goes back to Stephen's statement. If the standards don't need changing, we need to change the behavior, then let's lead the behavior of change through the principles of disclosure. So that it only ever comes out as a practice statement rather than an ultimate exposure, full standard. But there are some low-hanging fruit that do need standard amendments.
I suppose one of the outcomes of the principles of disclosure could be rather than a new general disclosure standard is selected amendments to ISB.
But do you think we can have a behavioral change without some form of change to the literature? Because everyone agrees there is a problem. Everyone agrees something must be done. And no one is moving because something is blocking. And maybe what we can do is kind of unleash.
But
we have to do something, not exactly a standard, maybe something else, as you said,
yes.
But we must do something.
Yes, an agent of change.
Yeah.
I know the ISB doesn't like, but they're your standards, and you have to enforce them. And the way you can enforce them is to point out where the enforcers are misinterpreting.
I don't see what's wrong with IAS 1. I mean, it says pretty clearly, an entity need not provide a specific disclosure required by an IFRS if the information is not material. I mean, how clear do we have to write?
Arjun, what was the paragraph reference?
I think you're referring to the comparative information.
Yes.
About so in the contingent liability.
Which paragraph is this?
It's on that. You've got the slides. I haven't got them.
Oh. It's in slide 7.
Yeah, but what's the reference?
Yes, paragraph 86 of IAS 37.
Paragraph
37.
37, it was one that says unless it permit otherwise.
86 of 37.
Yeah. Stephen, yeah, it's IAS 1, paragraph 38. the minimum comparative information. So our regulator is saying that that paragraph overrides the materiality, because except when IFRS is permit or other required. And they're saying because it's within it, it refers to other IFRSs and not the IAS 1. It's like it's a negative inside the same paragraph. It's inside the same standard. IAS 1, para 38.
Have we heard that from anybody else?
But Stephen, what about the point I think was raised earlier? Say you're a bank and you happen to have property, plant and equipment, but it's 1% of the total balance sheet, or 0.5%. Or you are a software company and you happen to have physical inventory, but it's I do believe many times people read the disclosures and even the materiality as topic by topic rather than in relation to the total company. So we would be, if we concluded, and I'm not that I'm a fan of negative assurance, but if we would be bold enough to say, well, we are a bank and we are not providing any disclosures on property, plant and equipment because it's immaterial from the balance sheet perspective, therefore none are disclosed.
That's fine.
Would that
good? Is the problem our definition of materiality? Because I can't see why it's not clear.
But people are very reluctant to do it, I believe. Materiality for the company or materiality for this topic? Or
The words we have, I can't see how we can write these words any clearer.
Are you referring to the paragraph 38 or in general?
Well, 38 is a bit confusing, I agree.
Yes!
That is on the public record, yay! Isn't it?
Can we get another board member in, please? Then we'll have a meeting.
But I don't see that it applies to materiality.
Because, 38, I think, is a good example of what's happening. People look at the second sentence and say, all right, comparative information for narrative and descriptive information I only have to provide if it's relevant. Okay. So obviously, the stuff in the sentence before, we've got to provide that even if it's not relevant.
No, I just...
So why is there a difference? Why doesn't the whole sentence say provide comparative information if relevant? Why do we say for all numbers you've got to provide, and if relevant, you've got to provide more?
Sounds like an annual improvement question.
If you have a bank and you have your balance sheet has 2 foot, the total has to represent all assets, right? So you would have a line item, other assets. Like a grouping PP&E, the small amount
of PP&E. Many banks have a lot of property.
A little bit of whatever they have. Lease, rights to the rest of use of leasing, maybe. Also small assets which total an amount which represents 1% of total balance sheet.
But Philippe, that is back on behavioural change.
Okay.
Because IAS 16 exists.
Okay. Let's assume I follow Malcolm's view. So I have financial assets, etc., trade receivable, cash equivalent, and I have a line other assets. And then I have total balance sheet. This other asset represents 1% of my total balance sheet, so who cares? And that is PP&E, rights of use of leasing, and maybe small inventories of whatever they have, checkbooks or whatever. And then it's called other. Fine. And would you have any disclosure of what is the nature of the other, or would you just be silent totally? Which people might think that this other is anything, and does it raise any question about the nature? You don't have to break it down by say this PPA and stuff, but would there be some question by people say, why do they have other, even if it's 10 million, which is 1% of total balance sheet, but 10 million would be.
So
it's fine. But say, no, I don't give any information about this other. This other, that's it.
So ignore your bank argument. You've solved Christoph's problem. He's now going to move inventory to other.
We've got that.
He's got to move it somewhere.
We don't have a line item inventory on our balance sheet anymore.
It just goes to other.
It is under other. Then we have for other. We got to say that this includes. Oh. Then. But we don't provide an amount, and that's all we do.
I have to say, Philippe, I haven't, and there is an interaction with your materiality guideline. I don't know your examples, but I have to say, at least in the group I've been thinking about that, there was a feeling that some of the examples in your materiality guideline statement should be more concrete. And so perhaps even take an example like you've just outlined and say, okay, well, we could envisage that some of these topics, say inventory for a bank or whatever, you know, the whole category within material would be immaterial, therefore you don't have to cover it. I mean, I don't know, perhaps I'm doing you a disservice.
I think we do have something along those lines. And we do talk about materiality in ultimately is a decision based on the financial statements as a whole, and we talk about that as well. So I do think there is discussion on that point in the materiality practice statement, but we'll take on board this point in looking at including in the feedback we have to make sure it's really brought out.
Well, Christy, didn't the IS1 changes of last year, they said if materiality's saying footnote in the fixed asset for a bank is in the context of the statements as a whole, not the subject matter, you know, and directly to your question. So, I mean, bank with £1 trillion of footings of assets, you know, $100 million of ordinary, you know, leasehold improvements and branch rents and stuff just doesn't feel like material when there's nothing controversial about it. So I'm just giving a reaction.
Okay. Maybe one in addition, I think our group also discussed, okay, should the ISB maybe go through one or two standards and try to show how to improve maybe the requirements, how we can maybe also the principles, how we should do it. And there was, I think, common sense that we should do it and demonstrate really that we're doing something visible in addition to this more general principle-based stuff and maybe picking at the share-based compensation standard or pension, like where you also demonstrated that maybe companies have 9-10 pages and going through that and test that if really we can do all the improvements, low-hanging fruit, and doing that. Would the group also agree to? The whole group agree to what's this feeling of them?
Yeah. I mean, perhaps it was my suggestion, but I mean, the idea of having disclosures as a tier one and tier two type disclosures. Has that ever, and tier two just being still audited perhaps, but just made on the web and would not have to be included in the full set of financial statements? And is there any discussion of that?
I think we have not discussed, but I personally think it is the same we discussed last week in the advisory council, also this idea of core and non-core. And I think the main problem is that somebody has to be there and identify what is core, what is non-core, as the same is, I think, with the level one, level two. That is, I think, the difficulty. Mine as the idea, I would agree, but who is then deciding on that? Is it the standard setter, or is it then the preparer who is always doing that? And that is very, very difficult, I think.
And frankly, if it is audited, now I'm in a world in which the only way of communicating my financial statements is in a digital way by putting them on my website. What would that tier one, tier two, tier one and tier two, it's both audited, it's both on my website. Is that only because it is in different PDFs? What would be this?
I don't know, perhaps it depends on the jurisdiction. We heard one jurisdiction this morning where apparently nothing has to be sent in to shareholders. I'm still living in a jurisdiction that's a bit paper-based and actually the whole financials have to be made available to, have to be at least made available, not physically posted, but made available to all of the shareholders. And I think it just means that if in the views of the management, they view those secondary disclosures as purely compliance disclosures and not material to understand the business, you know, I think the very fact that they are left out of the primary set of financial statements means that you don't have to look at them in order to understand the performance of the business.
But I don't really understand that idea, because if that was the case, why would you require them at all? I mean, or why would you have them at all?
Exactly. We would conclude, if that is the case, it is not material to understand the business, then we would say, okay, don't include it.
That's
cool. But that's really the question, who is then determined what is. Should we go to group three? Yeah. Olivia?
So I have shared what we have done in 2014. We have restructured our financial statements. We have, first we group the notes by thema, items, I would say. For example, you have personal costs, pensions, IFRS 2 altogether, because it's about personal, I would say. We have also a note on working capital with the variation of the working capital, the link between the opening balances to the closing balances, and the link with the financial statement. And we have another note, which is quite important for us, about net cash financial position, which was net debt is if it is on the liability side, or net cash financial position is if it is on asset side. These notes regroups many information, some about the P&L, in income and charges on results, on financial results, other on the assets, the detail of assets and liabilities, financial assets, financial liabilities for industrial and sales company, because we have we are a group which has different activities. We have industrial and sales companies on one part, and a banking company on another part. And we think that they are so different that we should not present a single balance sheet, or a single P&L, or a single cash flow statements. We always present an industrial and sales company on one column, financial activities on another column, elimination, and the aggregate. And this information is very important for us, because the net financial position, or the net debt, is the position that is needed to finance the activity of sales and industrial companies. And we always give to analysts, to users, the free cash flow of those activities and the net financial position. And these key items are disclosed in a separate new global note with the details of the amount, the details of the amounts linked to the financial statements on the face of the financial reporting. And we also give the movements between the opening and the closing balances linked with the cash flow statements. And also we give in the same notes, we give the a short description of financial of accounting policies. The accounting policies are now in each part of the notes. They are not at the beginning. At the beginning it's very short, it's only reference to IFRS, and in each part of the notes we explain the principles, because I like to have the main principles when I read the financial statements of others. For example, if they are US GAAP, I would like to see the main principles of the US GAAP, because I am not reading US GAAP today, every day. So I like to have the highlights of the principles, and I think that other groups would like to have the same on the highlights of the principles, of our reference principles. And so we give highlights in every part, and then we give the figures of the period. We give the main details of, for example, new financing, reimbursements, and so on. The timing of payments of the debt, also all information about IFRS 7 and the financing policy, how we cover the risk and so on, all in the same chapter, because it is all about financing, I would say. And we make it for industrial and sales company on one part, and we make another disclosure for financing activities on another part. because it is not at all the same business. So we did it in 2014 because the French regulator IMF has encouraged groups to do so in 2014 after some groups had done it in 2013. So we take example on them and we decide to do it in 2014. And we continue that year. And every year we look at the information and we always ask ourselves with our auditors if the information we give is really important, if it is useful for users or it is not so useful and we take it out. And if we have another thing to say that we did not say before because it becomes useful, so we look at our financial statement every year. And that has been appreciated by the supervisory board that find it more easy to read, and also by the French regulator.
Okay. Any comments to that? Additions, questions?
Well, just make a comment, maybe they cap this section off. We're getting close to the end, I think we are. I just say it's commendable what you did. I would just say pejoratively, and not being nasty, it sounds like rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic. I'm sorry, but our ship's not sinking. The ship's underwater. And Kevin, I'm not sure this is a compliment, but maybe taking his insult is we should use South Africa as our petri dish. And so what I understand is South Africa doesn't require these statements to go anywhere except on the website. And I think Kevin has indicated that 90 people, if they're not, probably some of the same of them, so it's probably less than 90 people, want and actually looked at them. Hey, our product's not selling. Our product is horrific. But we just can't seem to step up to the plate and figure it out as a profession. It's pretty embarrassing. But I think South Africa would be an example of who's actually using this stuff. Maybe it's the regulators. Maybe the regulators want to explain why we're spending this massive amount of money to produce this stuff. If it's not for the capital markets, but for the regulators. Hopefully you won't disagree with me. But
no, I don't. In fact, this sounds terrible, but I think the proof of the pudding is what happens to our share prices after we publish the interim year-end data and what happens to our share prices when we publish the annual report. Generally, when you publish that report, nothing happens to your share price. Everything happens when you publish that preliminary annual results. And so that seems to be what people are concentrating on, not the 130 pages.
Yeah, ideally, nothing should happen when you publish your intakes, because if you have properly dealt with your investor relations and informed the market, that even should not move at a time.
You obviously don't understand regulation FD.
Sorry.
I do understand
FD.
About this kind of argument, I think when every company now is releasing their results prior to publishing the annual report, and that's the reason for that. And I would not conclude that then the value of the annual report is nothing worse. I think that's I would think it's not the wrong conclusion.
Well, no, I'm saying it becomes then the compliance document as opposed to the.
It is a kind of compliance.
Public
relations. Right.
You can ask the question whether the difference between what you pre-release and your earnings release, which in most cases are primary statements, and all the rest, what the relevance of all the rest if nobody's interested and nobody reacts to it. When we issue our annual report, the only thing that people are interested in, because everything, all the financials, the primary statements were out already and segment reporting were already before. I did a session with press and analysts and gave them the report and gave them 5 minutes and walked around. Everyone was opening the same page and was only looking for one specific piece of information, which was board compensation. That's all they wanted to know from all the notes. That was all they were interested in, board compensation, and whether one of the co-CEOs earns more than the other.
Can I ask a question, Kevin and,
yeah.
and Christoph? Is the level of disaggregation about information just in the financial statements, set aside all of the other parts of the annual report, is the level of disaggregation of the P&L, say, for example, or the balance sheet, the same in the press release and the annual report?
Yeah.
It depends on what you call disaggregation. Our press release is a full IAS 34 compliant document, and so it's got full details of segments. It just doesn't have pensions, share-based payments, fixed assets, other assets, and all that extra. It doesn't have financial management, capital disclosures.
So, but there's no more detail about the components
no.
of income, expenses, assets and liabilities, and equity in the press release compared with. So hence I understand why the market doesn't necessarily react, unless, of course, there's guidance provided about the forward-looking.
That's in our press release.
That's why there's a reaction there and not generally from the end report. I would submit to you, if in fact there was more disaggregation, meaning more relevant information, there might be a different reaction to the market.
But hold on, there is more disaggregation. So whatever disaggregation you do in the notes is something you don't have at the earnings release. You got the primary statements, but everything that gives you more detail on the different line items is not in the earnings release. That only comes with the full financials.
Yeah.
Any disclosure around policies and stuff is not in the earnings release. It's only in the final report.
Well, to the extent that policies don't change, I wouldn't expect to change. But to the extent that the annual report or the quarterly report essentially explains that elements of income and expense that were in the press release are of a quote-unquote non-persistent, non-recurring nature, or they are one-off items, or in fact there are some new items in that category, then I would expect the market to react, if in fact investors and analysts are reading that information carefully. But if they're just essentially taking what was served up 6 weeks or 8 weeks earlier, then you're right. You wouldn't expect there would be much of a reaction. But this is I think the frontier for financial reporting. It's how you're going to deliver more timely, disaggregated information that is going to differentiate the persistent and non-recurring elements of income, expense, assets, and liabilities in a way that is not only standardized, but at the same time permits a company to do what Malcolm is talking about, which is tell the story in accordance with management's eyes. The other major element or aspect, I think, of this disaggregation has to be breaking down the components of income and expense between what is a cash and a non-cash change.
Yeah. All done.
Okay, current period transactions that generated cash versus fair value measurements or accounting estimates which had nothing to do with cash but add lots of pennies to earnings per share, which affect obviously the market's perception of how you're doing. And today that is, you know, a needle in a haystack for most investors. So
okay, running out of time for this session, but we have still three comments. Please be brief.
For our earnings press release, we don't provide the same level of detail as what's in our financial statements. The market moves when we do our press release, when we file our 10K. You don't see the same type of market movement. We do total revenues. We do total costs and deductions. And then income taxes going down to net income. For cash flow statement, we only have investing activities as a total and operating activities as a total. So much more summarized type of information, and the other item that can move the market is our reserves press release that comes out before our financial statements as well. So that level of detail is much different.
Philip,
I'd just like to go back to this discussion or the conversation with Kevin. When you issue your press release, your preliminary earnings press release, what makes the market price change? Is it the guidance you give about forward-looking information, or is it because the market discovers something they were not expecting or were not aware of on your past financial performance?
It's a bit of both. So let me give some color to our press release. Our press release is 35 pages. So it's a full set of financial statements of the primaries, and then all of the necessary notes to provide color to those primaries as required under IAS 34. So I'm sitting here listening to what Pat was saying, and I'm going, so why can't that actually be my annual report? Because there's even an MD&A in it. And if the IAS 34 already allows me to go to what's material to the user based on what you published a year ago, because I give two interims. I give a 6-month and I give a 12-month. Full IAS 34, 35 odd pages. And that would, I think, it would qualify as my annual report if I'm applying the real principles of materiality, because it's just the, you know, the 14 pages of accounting policies, you know, which theoretically on the web, and I'm done. I don't do all of the other disclosures in the thing. So why does the market change? Some of it's a surprise. We produce more ounces than they thought we were going to do, or we managed, because of the way emerging market currencies have gone, they didn't guess correctly how much our foreign currency gains would be from emerging markets converted back into dollars. So a lot of it is a surprise. In terms of gold mining, you know, I did 4 million ounces last year, I'm doing 4 million ounces this year, I'm doing 4 million ounces next year. You can work out the gold price. I can tell you what my cash costs are. You'd come within 10% of this year's profits. It's not difficult if I don't have impairments.
One comment from my side on that, because I worked in a bank in normal times. Maybe you are right, some press releases and press releases and which moved the market. But in the crisis, I think then when you have detailed disclosure about your subprime exposure, about whatever, I think then the detail matters. So we cannot say, okay, that kind of what we're disclosing in detailed information is not relevant. And then is people comparing really the details. Depending on times, depending on topics, depending on what is currently high risk area and whatever.
Martin, that nicely fits to what I said this morning. What is the scenario we should have in mind when thinking about what disclosures to make? If there is currently no financial crisis, should we make the disclosure that you need in non-financial crisis times? Or should we make the disclosure that might be useful if tomorrow, the day after we issue the report, a financial crisis comes up? So is it really something for the, that's what I meant by the worst case scenario? Should I make disclosures that cover each and every scenario that could occur?
No, that is not what I said. But the bank in that time, which had a good detailed disclosure about their credit risk exposure, was better off than a bank which had not a standard really the kind of disclosure, because they had to develop it. And therefore, I think there was uncertainty in the market, and there should be a standard of, I think, detailed disclosure which should enable then users to get their judgment not only on the high level positions but in a little bit more detailed about risk and performance. And I think that maybe it's different in time, but I think it is a standard which should enable also in different cycles where we are, should enable users to make their judgment on the valuation of the company.
But isn't some of that also in country specific? Sorry, maybe, because you've got IAS 34 already. But if the country specific allows you not, that you don't have to do the full year as an IAS 34, well then you've got this long period.
We had last week's ZMAC meeting, and there were some users who were saying, okay, they want to have this detailed information which we provide only for annual reports at each quarter, because for their valuation models they need this detailed information. Steve.
More for Kevin, I'm afraid. So your 34 pages, I presume, I think you said, doesn't include the pensions note?
Doesn't include the pensions note.
Can we withdraw all the disclosure requirements in IAS 19?
Pardon?
Could we withdraw, therefore, all of the disclosure requirements in IAS 19?
For our business, I have no problem if we were to abolish the disclosure requirements.
Is that because it's not material?
Because for me, it's not material. I can't say IAS 19 is not material from a CMAC lady who was no longer on the CMAC, who said that British Airways is an airline that flies a pension fund that flies aeroplanes. So I think it just depends on who you are. But for us, IAS 19 is definitely not material.
Can I ask a question related to that? Can a reader of your press release understand how much the change in net pension assets and liabilities contributed to EPS?
They can see that last year's pension fund asset was $28 million and this year's pension fund asset is $20 million.
But that doesn't answer my question. Can they tell how much the change in net pension assets and liabilities contributed to earnings per share?
Not much.
It went down by $8 million. Dollars. Not much.
They know that.
My total pension asset is 28.
Different purpose, yeah.
I don't know what the numbers are in your, right. So I don't know how material that is.
Oh, I've got $5 billion in revenue, $1.9 billion in operating profits.
So you're saying that it was an immaterial change to profit and loss.
And that's why it didn't appear in my ISB4 interims.
But you just said net. What's the gross numbers?
223. They're in the thing, 223 and 260.
Maybe in the tenth of percents, not the hundreds.
Yeah, I've got $6 billion in tangible assets. The pension gross is 228, 223. I've got 157 active members, 583 pensioners, but 32,000 employees.
So have you tried with the auditors to leave out the note?
Get back to the question. Is IAS 1... Is the standard the issue, or is it the financial statement taken
circle.
As a whole? It's that circle.
He has achieved to reduce it to one page, so I think. So, I think that was the discussion on.
Wait a minute. Sorry. Isn't it also important for the readers to know that out of your 32,000 employees, only 150 do have a right to a pension? It's important to know because. If I know your company has 32,000 employees, I could expect that you have a significant liability. I'm happy to know that you have an insignificant liability. It's an important fact for me.
Well, you can do that.
You see,
sentence,
but that's back into. I'm not going to put
it
in a sentence.
But I will not take off all disclosure because I need to know that.
No.
It's back to the question, should you disclose all the non-important information just to say that they are not important?
Constant.
You know, I'm being rude here and I apologize up front. If you want to be a shareholder in my company, you need to do due diligence. If management said that there's no pensioners that are relevant because it's made the materiality call, if you don't like it, it's sell the shares. If you think I'm lying, sue the board. But you've got to give me the discretion to prepare the financial statement
Fair
the
enough.
Way I'm
Fair
expected
enough.
To.
The important information is that it is not material. I need to know it.
Well, it's
not material.
Unless
so
you don't trust them.
So Philippe,
and his auditors asleep
so
at the
when
switch.
I get back and we finalise this year's annual report, I will include a statement that says we are not a bank. Because it might be material for your understanding.
Despite what the footnotes may look like, we're not a bank.
Okay. Stop that.
We're Microsoft. We are a software company.
Thank you very much. I'll move to a...